sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl.
I'm joined on the show today by fellow 9/11 radio show host and researcher, Frank Tolupko. Frank, welcome to the show.
Thanks. Great to be here.
A recent show that Frank and I produced was criticized by a listener. I actually met with the listener to hear their concerns, and one of the things that they brought up was that we know that the official story of 9/11 is true because we have all the videos of the hijackers boarding the planes. But actually, in truth, there are no videos of that. And so this show today is speaking to that, about the hijackers, the videos, getting on the planes, some of them still alive, etc.
Why don't we first go to a audio clip, which was from a BBC TV broadcast a few days after the events of September 11, 2001, where at that point the FBI had already identified the putative 19 hijackers.
And here's that clip.
Last week, the FBI, having gathered evidence, confidently issued the 19 names of those who had seized the four planes. Many of them were from Saudi Arabia. Now it appears that some people with those names are still alive. The FBI is working on the possibility that the hijackers used stolen identities. All of this complicates linking the attacks to Osama bin Laden.
Take the case of these three men. Is this really Abdulaziz al-Umari, the man in the airport picture? Not according to one Arabic newspaper who says it's spoken to a Mr. al-Umari in Saudi Arabia. Then there's Walid al-Shahri, another man named as a hijacker, but whose father says now lives in Morocco. And finally, there's also doubt about Khalid al-Midar. Officials are thought to be looking at the possibility the name may have been an alias.
So within hours after the events of September 11th, the FBI came up with a list of supposed hijackers, which they quickly changed a few days later because some of the people, they could not be verified. The BBC went out and with the list that had been given and did some research in Europe and found out that a good number of those people that were identified were actually still alive. And in fact, they had showed up in American embassies saying, hey, why are you accusing me of being a hijacker? I'm alive. And oh, and by the way, my passport was stolen a few years ago. So obviously they had a juried up list that they put up initially that had no basis in fact. The BBC later, after much controversy over this issue, about 5 years later, the BBC came up, not with a retraction, but an attempt at explaining why they put out that list that the FBI had given them. It basically boiled down to the fog of war argument that's always used when the initial reports proved to be misguided or actually false. In fact, all they did was, they didn't apologize, they made a change to the story in print. Actually, the story was also in print, where they changed one of the identified putative hijackers to a man called Walid al-Shahri. And then they said that they were very confident that the story, as it was, remained true because they got in touch with the FBI and the FBI issued a statement saying that the FBI is confident that it has positively identified the 19 hijackers responsible for the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Also, the 9/11 investigation was thoroughly reviewed by the National Commission on Terrorist Attacks upon the United States, that's commonly known as the 9/11 Commission, and the House and Senate Joint Inquiry. Neither of these reviews ever raised the issue of doubt about the identity of the 19 hijackers. Fact of the matter is though the 9/11 Commission report doesn't talk about it at all in their final report.
And now we're going to hear a clip from the film Loose Change, talking about the hijackers that are still alive and actually what countries they're in and where they are.
It's the funniest thing, but at least nine of them are still alive. Walid al-Shahri is a Saudi Airlines pilot in Casablanca, Morocco. Whale M. al-Shahri is alive and well. Abdulaziz al-Umari is a Saudi Airlines pilot living in Saudi Arabia. Mohand al-Shahri is alive in Saudi Arabia. Khalid al-Midar is a computer programmer in Mecca. Salam al-Hamzi works at a chemical plant in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. Saeed al-Ghamdi is training to be a pilot in Tunis. Ahmed al-Nami is an administrative supervisor for Saudi Airlines. And last but not least, Mohammed Atta's father claimed to receive a phone call from his son on September 12th. 14 of the hijackers based their training in Florida, and the five that allegedly hijacked Flight 77 lived in a motel right outside the gates of the NSA. Not to mention, the official autopsy report for Flight 77 does not list the hijackers, and the opening paragraph makes no mention of their absence. After these discrepancies were pointed out, FBI Director Robert Mueller brushed it off, saying that the hijackers were using stolen passports and may not have had tickets, so there's no way to know who they actually were. So, if there's no proof that the hijackers were members of Al-Qaeda, or if they were even on the plane in the first place, what justification do we have for bombing Afghanistan?
So even though at least 9 of the 19 hijackers are known to be still alive, have identified themselves in their countries where they're working, the U.S. government continues to use these original 19 names, and it's even in the museum in New York City, in the 9/11 museum, they still list these 19 men, even though 9 of them are known to be alive.
On September 21st, 2001, approximately 10 days after the events of September 11th, the Los Angeles Times published an article with the headline, FBI Chief Raises New Doubts Over Hijackers' Identities. And I'll quote from the article briefly. FBI Director Robert Mueller acknowledged that investigators may not know the true identities of some of the 19 suspected airline hijackers from last week's suicide attacks. Mueller said last week that he had a, quote, a fairly high level of confidence, close quote, that the FBI knew the real names of hijackers based on flight manifests and follow-up interviews. But while in Pennsylvania on Thursday, and that's going back to the original article, for a tour of the crash site there, he raised fresh doubts about the accuracy of the identifications. We have several hijackers, he said, whose identities were those of the names on the manifests, Mueller said. We have several others that are still in question. The investigation is ongoing, and I am not certain as to several of the others. Officials refuse to say how many hijackers may have used false identities, but officials of the Saudi Arabian government, our ally in the Middle East, said Thursday that 6 of the men that the United States has named as hijackers killed in the attacks appear to be living in the Middle East. Now, going back to what I said earlier, Mueller says that they had access to the manifests and look at the flight manifests, which are a legal requirement of every airline to name and track everybody that get boards a flight. Those have never been released to the public, the original manifests. What have been released and have been quoted as saying that their manifests are really the victim lists. And the victim list did not include any of the putative hijackers. They were asked about that, and they said, well, we didn't want to sully the names of the other people that died in the terrorist attacks. So why are they holding back the manifests?
Yeah, one really has to ask, why haven't we ever seen authenticated passenger lists? What might they be hiding?
Back in March of 2010, a Mr. Fujita, chief of Japan's Democratic Party, publicly stated that the 9/11 story as presented officially is a hoax and that many of the hijackers are alive. Here we will now listen to David Ray Griffin, esteemed theologian and 9/11 researcher, being asked about this particular issue.
The 9/11 hijackers are alive and well. That's according to the chief of Japan's Democratic Party, who says 9/11 is a hoax. Dr. David Ray Griffin is a professor and author who wrote the book, The New Pearl Harbor Revisited. He joins us from Santa Barbara, California. So I'm guessing that you think that, and this is just an assumption on my part, that maybe this parliamentarian from Japan may have a point in determining whether 9/11 was really a hoax or not?
Oh, absolutely. The physical evidence is so strong for the destruction of the World Trade Center by explosives that we're really in the level of proof now, not conjecture. So on that score, I've just written a book on World Trade Center 7. It's called The Mysterious Collapse of World Trade Center 7, Why the Official Story, the Final Official Account of 9/11 is Unscientific and False. And in that book, give a massive amount of evidence that's been compiled by scientists, architects, and engineers that all three buildings, although in that book I focus on World Trade Center 7, were brought down by explosives. There's simply no other possibility. And the only way that NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, which wrote the official report, the only way they were able to deny that was to commit massive scientific fraud, which in simple words simply means they lied, and they lied.
Dr. Griffin, the politician who I'm talking about in Japan, his name is Yukihisa Fujita, and his claims are that 8 of the 19 hijackers are still alive and well, that this was all created by not necessarily terrorists, but people who are trying to benefit off the stock market. How much of this argument are you buying from Mr. Fujita? Or do you believe that it is kind of an inside job, but for other reasons?
Well, first of all, we have to be careful about this Washington Post editorial. Fujita himself says that they really distorted what he said. So we can't take that too seriously. But that said, certainly let's take the issue of the hijackers, whether there were eight or so. We certainly know that some were still alive after 9/11. Walid al-Shiri, for example, showed up in Morocco and gave a press conference. The BBC reported on it, and they said there's no doubt about the fact that he is the man, because they had published, FBI had sent his picture around the world, and it was the same man. And then there's his brother. And yet when the 9/11 Commission wrote its account, they said that Walid and Wael al-Shiri were the ones probably on Flight 11 who stabbed the flight attendant. So they just ignored the fact that these two guys were still alive.
Dr. Griffin, real quickly, then the question becomes to you, why? Why would the government kind of cover this up, hide all this information?
Well, what we have here is an extreme example of something that governments, imperialistic governments, have done for a very long time. They're called false flag operations. You attack your own people. You blame another country or another group that you already had reasons to want to attack. Hitler did this when he was ready to attack Poland. That's how World War II got started. Japan did it when they were ready to attack Manchuria. That's how the Asian part of World War II got started. Our government did it in this case, planting evidence that these attacks were carried out by members of Al-Qaeda. But it's interesting that even our FBI says they do not list Osama bin Laden as wanted for 9/11. Now, our news media generally won't tell the people that, but it's the fact. And when one of our people asked the FBI, why don't you list Osama bin Laden as wanted for 9/11? The fellow who was the head of investigative publicity said, because we have no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden was responsible for 9/11.
Okay, Dr. David Ray Griffin, author, thank you so much for joining us.
And now we're going to take a look at the videos that don't exist of the alleged hijackers boarding the planes, along with the videos of the alleged hijackers at the airports in Portland, Maine and Washington, D.C., that do exist but have proven to be fabricated. So to begin with, I'm going to read a passage from the book called Hijacking America's Mind on 9/11, Counterfeiting Evidence by Elias Davidson. And it's on page 50, and here goes. Apparently none of the three airports from where the 9/11 aircraft reportedly departed, Boston's Logan, Newark International, and Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C., had surveillance cameras above the boarding gates. There exists neither eyewitness testimony nor a visual documentation of the boarding process. The Boston Herald reported a few weeks after 9/11, quote, in perhaps the most stunning example of Massport's lack security safeguards, Logan International Airport is missing a basic tool found not only in virtually every other airport, but in most 7-Elevens. While Massport does employ cameras in the parking garages, ramp areas, and on Logan's roadways to monitor traffic, there are none to be found in the terminals, gate areas, or concourses. You have names of hijackers, but the FBI has said it hasn't been able to match the faces of those who were on the flights, said Charles Slepian, a New York security consultant. Logan officials acknowledge this deficiency. This is significant because two of the 9/11 flights originated from Logan Airport. According to the 9/11 Commission staff, Newark International Airport, from which flight United 93 reportedly departed, did not have such equipment. According to the 9/11 Commission's final report, there is no documentary evidence to indicate when the hijackers passed through the security checkpoints, what alarms may have been triggered, or what security procedures were administered. Yet public opinion remains convinced that surveillance videos of the suspected hijackers have been shown on television. Indeed, something was shown around the world on television, but not the boarding process of any of the four aircraft. What was shown were two short video clips of people passing a security checkpoint, one reportedly from the Portland, Maine jetport, and the other from Dulles Airport in Washington, D.C. The video from Portland Jetport purports to show suspected hijackers Ada and Alomari passing the security checkpoint before they board a flight to Boston on the morning of September 11, 2001. Its authenticity has been disputed for two reasons. One, Michael Toohey, who checked in Ada and Al-Omari at the Portland Jetport, said on CNN that during check-in that they had on ties and jackets. Shown the security video, he discovered that they have like dress shirts with open collar. No one could explain what happened to their jackets. Number two, the security video displays two different recording times. And now we're going to hear from Jay Kolar speaking at the Toronto hearings in 2011, which Frank and I both attended, and here he is discussing the videos.
It's now my pleasure to introduce the first of today's expert witnesses, Jay Kolar. Jay Kolar is a freelance writer in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. As a film studies instructor, he has taught courses in film analysis and mass media at Lane Community College, the University of Iowa, and the University of California at Los Angeles, UCLA. A specialization in French film theory, semiotics, and close structuralist analysis of film stimulated his critical response to the events of September 11, 2001, leading him to examine more closely the available 9/11 footage and subsequent releases of Bin Laden and alleged hijacker Last Will and Testament martyrdom videos. Jay Kolar is the author of an essay, What We Now Know About the Alleged 9/11 Hijackers, in The Hidden History of 9/11, a book edited by Paul Zaremka and first published by Elsevier Press in 2006. He supplemented this essay with an update in the expanded edition published in 2008 by Seven Stories Press in New York. Jay Kolar will present his evidence on the subject of the alleged 9/11 hijackers. Jay Kolar.
Well, I want to change that title to the 9/11 hijackers that weren't. I say that because the U.S. government's story, upon close examination of the evidence, of which I'm only going to be able to present a small segment today, reveals an accumulation of flaws, distortions, omissions, video forgeries, alterations of the alleged hijackers' timelines, fabricated evidence, planted evidence, substitutions of names and doubles for the alleged, intimidation of eyewitnesses and whistleblowers, and up to now, media blacking out of protected activities of some of the alleged who had deep political connections. Under the weight of all these flaws, the official story collapses. We begin with the FBI's initial list of hijackers, which should have been released concurrently with a flight manifest that were never released after the FBI had quickly confiscated them. The FBI said it had located its suspects from those manifests, not to be mistaken for the passenger lists made available by the airlines, which contained none of the 19 names. But within 24 hours, CNN had acquired this first FBI list from U.S. Customs, and one of the relevant customs officials is Robert Bonner. But it contained five names: a Moziar Kanid on Flight 77, and four others, Adnan Bukhari, Amir Bukhari, Amir Kamfar, and Abdul Rahman Al-Omari. From the Flight 11 manifest, names that the FBI dropped and replaced with Walid Anwa'il Al-Sheri, Satam El-Sukami, and Abdul Aziz Al-Omari. Logically, that would mean that there should have been, including the name of Mohammed Atta on that first Flight 11, who had not been replaced by a substitute, at least nine Arab names from which to choose. But there weren't. Since none of the airline lists, which only contain passengers minus hijacker names, contain any of those Arab names, which were changes the FBI had implemented, therefore tampering with crime scene evidence. It is important to note that reputable documented sources verified that at least nine of the FBI's second and final list of 19, the ones depicted here, were still alive after 9/11, with proof that at least one other, Ziad Jarrah, or Jarrah, had his identity doubled. The double's photo on a U.S. visa, one-third singed by the crash, showing someone who resembled more a young Tom Jones, the singer, and the real Jarrah's identity therefore fabricated and Jarrah himself framed. Nevertheless, the FBI has refused to make the necessary corrections to exonerate those 10 out of the 19 falsely accused. First, I'm starting with the U.S. government's best evidence, which we will see is actually the worst evidence of hijackers, the Dulles Airport video. Compare that, the Dulles video still, to a Portland Jetport video still on the left. The only other video we have of the alleged aborting planes on 9/11 was the one from the Portland Jetport, where in the frame on the left, Atta and Aziz Al-Omari proceeded to board a connecting flight, not the Flight 11 that crashed. While this disqualifies it as evidence of a flight that crashed, it does show the verifiable airport security data, which continues throughout the video's duration, the date, digital ongoing time of day, and the closed-circuit TV identification number, which reveals the camera's location, all necessary to authenticate an event as well as the video itself. The absence of such data on the still from the Dulles Airport video, on the other hand, is the first of six major problems we have with it. Unlike the Portland video and unlike every other airport surveillance video we've seen, it lacks verifiable authenticity, which can only come from imprinted security data, the date, the digital ongoing clock, and camera number. Researcher Joe Viales in 2004, through his connections, was able to obtain a Dulles Airport package, including outdoor photos of 9/11 Dulles Terminal. Viales meticulously examined every inch of the Dulles video, blown up over 20 times, but he could find no trace of edited out security data. Thus, lacking imprinted security data on the entire tape, standard for all airport videos, and without evidence to indicate erasure, there is no possibility that the Dulles video is authentic, hence the probability that it is a forgery. Devoid of such security data, both as a security video and as evidence of an event to be used in a court of law, what possible use could this video have? Located at an airport security checkpoint, a security camera that records without imprinting security data is completely suspect. Second, the presence of Salam al-Hazmi and Khalid al-Midhar allegedly preparing to board Flight 77 introduces the second problem. Both he and al-Midhar turned up still alive after 9/11. In al-Midhar's case, one report comes from the FBI itself, which warned all banks to watch for him after 9/11. Quote, on September 19, 2001, the FDIC distributed an official document clearly stating that al-Midhar is alive. As for Salem, he testified for himself that on 9/11 he was working at a Saudi petrochemical complex in Yanbu, Saudi Arabia. A third problem stems from the exterior lighting and shadows covered by Paul Zaremka, following on Vial's research on the exterior views in the Dulles video package he received. A Dulles Airport terminal exterior view shows the time would be around midday and not 7:18 a.m. when the hijackers allegedly entered the security checkpoint. The exterior lighting is too bright and the shadows are wrong for an early Washington, D.C. September morning. Okay, this photograph is simply a representative view, a sample, because the other is not available at this time from Joe Vial's closed-down website. But this sample exterior Dulles view suffices to show the immediate proximity of roadway just outside with a windowed entrance to the terminal. In this perspective, the security camera inside the security checkpoint is pointing screen left, which is north, and directly at the mostly windowed wall and entrance in the background. What I wanted you to notice here is that when we roll the video, you'll see one could expect to see some traffic in that background. We obviously don't. And that is in the 2006 video release, or after, that was found in the Misawi trial documents. Absence of any background traffic movement therefore also undermines the video's authenticity. It took 3 years for the original release of the Dulles Airport video in 2004. In a heavily edited, and they only showed heavily edited versions of between 57 seconds and 150, well, 2.5 minutes in duration, out of a possible 22 minutes from first to last alleged hijacker, which is a maximum of only 10% of total duration. Those initial versions have poorer, grainier resolution than most security videos, due partially to the bright sunshine streaming in, and about twice the brightness expected when facing this northern perspective at 7:18 a.m. Bright backlight tends to wash out the resolution, also indicating the taping time around noon or so. That is, unless the camera inside the building is not facing north, in which case this could not be Dulles. Either way, the authenticity of this video is undermined. To make viewing even more difficult, in the current version we have now from the Musawi trial documents, faces, this is an example, in the 2006 version are smudged out, not digitally, but they are disguised to prevent recognition. It looks like somebody took some sort of eraser on the film and just emulsified over the faces. Why would the U.S. government prevent its citizens from recognizing both the alleged and other passengers and officials? And why, in the 2004 original version, did they release only 57 seconds to 150 seconds max? in this minuscule Dulles Airport video versions in which 90% of total duration has been deleted, an obvious smudging of faces, noticeable as passengers come into focus in the foreground and obfuscate the remaining 10%. When all versions of the Dulles video have been made available in such a parsimonious way, and then only after family members had successfully sued for its release, the resultant effect is one of cover-up, not presentation of evidence. Okay, the fifth problem of the camera movement and visual manipulation, both of which I described in my chapter, which came out in 2006, at which time only the 2004 version, which was heavily edited, of the Dulles video was available. This heavy editing included cuts or splices, multiple sized views or shots of various sizes, medium shots, close-ups, and two inexplicable establishing long shots, but only one you'd expect from a closed-circuit TV camera. And also camera movement. Especially this camera movement appears in a shot which lasts 38 seconds in the Court TV 150-second version from 2004, which is follow-on action, zoomed in. By the way, I can't find that version anymore because that site has changed and it's no longer available. If you look at the floor stripe, it's moved. So you can see both, if you shoot the closed-circuit TV camera in the ceiling, is in one place at one time, and in 6 to 8 feet to the right in another time. You didn't notice it. Nobody noticed it when they saw it because of this 38-second slow motion, zoomed-in close-up of the alleged El Midhar walking left to right in more of a medium close-up in the foreground, which intervenes between those two shots. The one shot presented the first two hijackers who arrived, and the last shot showed the other two, which it's impossible in a purely mechanical operation of a closed-circuit TV camera. It betrays human intervention, selection, and exclusion of other passengers, not possible in the alleged closed-circuit camera the commission tells us we are getting our viewing experience from. It's no longer available from the Court TV site, but as I said, the photograms that we have are still happily available. And they reveal, besides the aforementioned evidence, the distinctly two camera setups. Are we then to conclude that there are two airport surveillance cameras embedded in the ceiling? So you can see the camera stripe moves. But we don't have any of this in the current 2000 released version, where they decided to leave all the editing out and just show you one view that was shot from above the center floor line, or centered over the floor line. Simultaneously with this new second setup after the intervening 38 seconds of El Midhar, another problem has occurred. The 150-second Court TV version, which temporarily the longest of the 2004 version, has somehow neglected to include anyone showing up as the pilot Hanjour, in quotes, between the arrival of the two duos. In the shortest version, ironically, the 57-second one, there is a very brief glimpse of a man, but he's not Hanjour. The overall difficulty in viewing these versions made available to the public is that they contain only a mere fraction of the approximately 22 minutes of this Dulles footage that's going by the commissions, noting that the time of arrival of the first alleged hijackers, the pair, and the arrival of the last pair. The darkly dressed, fully bearded, heavier set mystery man in the 2004 Dulles video, small version, appears starring in the role of Hanjour. So suddenly he appears in the Moussaoui trial documents. But that's still not him, okay? Would not have merited much attention for one very important reason. He was not Hanjour at all. Hence, challenging the integrity of the Dulles video is the fact that the FBI and the commission, having access to this ATM photo of Hanjour, would surely have noticed that the man dressed in dark slacks and dark short sleeve shirt does not remotely resemble Hanjour, yet they apparently tried to pass him off. From all the accounts we have of Hani Hanjour, he was slightly built, okay, thin, gaunt, just over 5 feet tall. The U.S. government had as its best evidence the Dulles video purportedly showing them preparing to board a plane that they said crashed into the Pentagon. All six of these problems, however, combined to undermine the Dulles video's authenticity and corroborate its forgery. It's the flimsiest evidence upon which the entire weight of the official story collapses. No airport security video has appeared for the other flights. Therefore, no evidence exists that any of the so-called hijackers ever boarded planes that crashed on 9/11.
So we spent the last half hour listening to various people talking about the veracity of the 9/11 official story, especially in reference to the so-called hijackers. So the only thing I would add to that is to piggyback on the phrase, show me the money, show me the manifests, show me the boarding passes, show me the unedited video, show me all the other stuff, and then maybe I'll believe it.
Frank, I want to thank you for being on the show today.
Pleasure to be here, as always.
This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.